Well, it is an enormous pleasure. I'm here in Tenby in Pembrokeshire to interview Anne and Vicky. And, of course, I've interviewed many people over the years with a strong Lampeter connection. But actually, I would say, of all the people I've interviewed, in terms of the Lampeter lineage and heritage, the two of you are absolutely the icing on the cake. Because do you want to just say what your connections with what is now, of course, the University of, or what was the University of Wales Lampeter in my days at David's University College before that?
Well, we went to Lampeter in 1953. We had been in Newport, where Dad was Dean of St Willow's, and he got the call to go to Lampeter. And so he and Mum upped sticks and went to Wild West Wales, I guess, which they thought of it at the time. And Dad took up the principalship. I was 2. Vicky was
a few months old.
So we arrived in Lampeter, and we were there, well, until Dad retired. So that was 1976, was it, Vicky?
Yeah.
And of course, I used to live in Burgess Hall, and the hall of residence that I overlooked with the red sort of roof was, of course, Lloyd Thomas. And, of course, your father was John Rowland
Lloyd Thomas.
Yes, exactly. So principal for almost a quarter of a century.
Almost, yes.
And would have been at a quite, I'm guessing, quite tumultuous time.
When he went there, he didn't think he'd be there very long.
No.
The college was in pretty dire straits, and they'd had about 3 moves. He'd been in Canton in Cardiff, married Mum, and they went to St Mark's in Newport, took on a house that needed decorating, thought, right, we'll be here for a while. Next thing, he's Dean of St Willow's. Again, a house needs decorating, we'll be here for a while. Get to Lampeter, the principal's lodgings were in the old building, and he thought, we won't be here very long. And, of course, 25 odd years later.
An experience, I think, many people who went to Lampeter, I mean, I thought 10 years was a long time, but I'm going to be meeting a few people this week who have been there since the 80s or even earlier in some cases, who are very much fixtures of the town. But you grew up there, so the two of you were very young, just as you said, either a few months old or a few years old in your respective cases. So you must have experienced some incredible changes during that period, particularly 1971, I would imagine, when Lampeter became part of the Federal University.
My memory of living in the college, that section, we were behind the chapel, when we had 22 rooms, bathrooms with spiders in and all kinds of things. And
attics and cellars.
Attics and cellars. It was a wonderful, it was our playhouse, the whole college was our
playhouse. The plaintive call of our childhood was, because there was a staircase up each side of the chapel, and it was, don't run up the stairs, chapel's on.
When we ran up the stairs, everything rattled on the altar.
And I'm guessing in that, in those days, not both the academic staff and the students would have been wearing gowns.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was very, because I mean, my sister went to Lampeter in 88, I went in 91. Yeah. But there was still talk even then, enough people who were there of that era or
it
just
was,
before.
It was men only at that time. And because Mum had 3 of us under 5, 3 little girls, she had help at home. She was lucky enough to have some help. But the help who lived in, the story was, because they had gates in those days, the students had to be back within the quad by about 10 o'clock, something like that. Yeah. And she apparently would open the door that linked from the principal's lodgings to the chapel, and it gave them a means of getting through into the quad.
I kind of feel this is the first time the secret has been outed.
We had a door in the back hallway that led into the chapel, and I think that was a kind of secret highway for lots of people.
But yes, we went, I suppose, seeing that era, just how much things have changed. Lampeter at that time was lots of little shops. Mum, when she went, she would go to Mark Lane stores and sit down, give her order. Little boy would come round on a bicycle sometime later, delivering whatever it was. Sometimes we'd be sent from the college to just get a loaf of bread or whatever. It was a safe, small town. But nobody sent. People like Mum and Dad would have everything on account. And a lot of the businesses wouldn't send their bills in very regularly, not once a month. You were lucky if it was once a year. And Dad would have a fit sometimes. The chemist's bill with all Mum's makeup would arrive. And they'd say, what? You spent how much? Or the butcher. And on one occasion, Mum got milk from 2 different sources. and the milkman at Wurndrew, was it, had a fire and lost his records. So he and Mum had to sit at the kitchen table and work out when they'd been there over the past year as to how much milk they probably had. And but I suppose it was trust.
But also knowing people. But also, because in those days, I mean, I was obviously there later again, but you know, you couldn't use credit cards, I don't think. Everything was cash. Mm. I think the Boots in town was one of the first places where you could actually use a debit card for payments. Yeah. And if you wanted your photographs done, they'd send them off to Carmarthen or Swansea, and you'd have to wait the best part of a week to get them back. Yeah. And you'd use the telephone box and queue up 6 o'clock in the evening because it was cheaper after six. Yeah. But those are things that were all very quaint part of the town. That was just the sort of the way things were. And I think for the vast majority of students, that was the sort of the way of life. And and you acclimatized to that. Yeah. But to see those shifts, I think, so what I think, you know, you must have seen both, even in the 20 odd years that you were there, you know, as the daughters of the vice, or the principal in those days, of course, not to look back on that era. When also I would imagine a significant number of the students would have been doing theology, or far more than perhaps in later years.
I think one of Dad's sort of battles, people always thought it was a theological college, and he would say, no, it was really liberal arts with a theological hall attached. Yeah. And
it's been something we've had all our lives to say, no, it wasn't a theological college. They said you could study theology there, but it had always...
I think when Dad went, there was still the tradition that the principal was somebody in holy orders.
That was in the charter.
Yeah. So again, that was that. Yeah. But I know he felt a great responsibility, I think, didn't he, towards Burgess Hall and those taking orders. And I can remember too in the evenings from sort of six till eight, there was a line of chairs, remember, outside Dad's study. Mm. There were always... students there waiting to see Dad about something. And I'm sure the talk was often about rugby or fishing rather than anything else. But
there was a nice tale from Adrian Davis, who was a student at Lampeter, and he had missed one of the compulsory chapels. I think the Lampeter rugby team had beaten, the college team had beaten the Lampeter team, and it had obviously been a big match. And they'd been celebrating afterwards, and anyway, missed chapel. And his bollocking from Dad was basically, well, don't do it again, but well done on the results.
I mean, that's a lovely sort of very sort of personal side, because when you mentioned that they'd all be queuing up to see your father, I mean, I suppose the image I always would have had of a principal or vice chancellor would be a very sort of, but of course I work in the university sector, but you imagine a very sort of austere, very distant sort of figure. But it sounds like he wasn't that at all.
No, he would try and watch all the rugby matches. Wouldn't he? He was very keen.
Well, he played cricket. And I don't think he played rugby. How old was Dad when he went to Lampeter? 1908. He was born, so
45.
As a student, he was there in the '30s.
Yeah. So he was
20s.
Yeah, but he still played cricket and
he used to do it for the old boys.
Yeah,
he?
And went to every match
until he couldn't get into his cricket trousers
anymore. Yes, played tennis too for a while. But he was a great sportsman, fisherman, and he wasn't a distant prince. There was very, how can I put it? There was a great respect for Dad. He did keep a slight distance, but he was very much...
The pastoral side was important to him.
I think as a parish priest, and he knew every cleaner, every cook, every... He was in the kitchens, he'd be in with a manciple, that's a lovely word, wasn't it? Manciple's office. Finance? Would it have been the finance office?
Partly, yes.
Yeah.
There were very few administrative staff when he went. It was basically him and the manciple.
He had one secretary.
A couple of secretaries.
Did, he did admissions. He did everything.
He did admissions, gosh.
He did admissions. Yeah. He did all the disciplinary stuff.
So, if you were a good rugby player, you had a chance of...
Of getting a fairly clean record. an exoneration, a mitigation.
And he typed most of his own letters. He was a great one for technology. He loved a dictaphone, anything new.
Because we remember his first secretary, Evelyn.
Auntie Evelyn,
we called her, and she had wonderfully sharp pencils for doing shorthand. And I there was a story of me running to Mum. She'd given me a pencil, and I tripped on the lino and went through my cheek. But then when the dictaphones came in, Yes,
I think the other joy was we had breakfast together as a family, then we walked to school in Bryn Road, to primary school. And
we always had lunch together. We came home for lunch. Lunch was the main meal of the day.
Dad usually was there for lunch as well. Came home from school in the afternoon. Dad would be there to have tea with us. Then you'd go off to chapel. Mm. We'd have some. So it was very, it was lovely having Dad there all the time, really. And
it was hard for Mum. She had come. Oh, yeah. She was trained as a nurse. She worked as a theatre sister for some time before she met Dad. And the way they met perhaps was quite fun, wasn't it? Mum was nursing in St Willow's. St Winifred's Hospital in Cardiff.
She was a war widow. Her first husband died in the war, after the war. And she was persuaded, I think she had a tough time with depression, I suppose it would be these days, after he died. And an Irish sister she trained with persuaded her to go back to nursing. And so you can carry on the story from there.
A Catholic hospital with nursing sisters.
Yeah.
And they were a lovely bunch. Mum was very fond of them all. But when the Catholic priest came, he was, treated with great respect and all the rest of it. But when Dad's parish was Canton then, when he came to visit patients, he wasn't exactly Lord, but not much fuss was made.
Handle an Anglican.
Yeah. So Mum used to make him a cup of tea. Yeah. And it started from there.
They were engaged within 3 months and married within 6. It was very quick. Dad was about 12 years older than Mum.
They were so fond of each other. It was.
And did you find, because obviously, so you were both very young at the time.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the family life, and it sounds as though there was a very enriching family life, which of course was possible because the town was so small, but. Being young children and having such an important father, did that have any sort of bearing on sort of friendship groups, sort of going to school? Was there a sense that you had a very kind of public preference? It was a bit like, I always think like the Prince of Wales' children or something, that inevitably there's always going to be a little bit interest in them. But did you sort of feel that things were, because you have nothing to compare it with, but were you kind of aware that people knew who you were?
Dad was a big fish in a small pond, but you were known for who your parents were. But I think that was throughout everyone to some extent.
Yeah.
Certainly as a teenager, I think, I don't like everybody knowing who I am, sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I feel I've come full circle now, and I'm living in a small community where everyone knows each other. And it's actually comforting now. But certainly as there was an element, particularly as a teenager, when you thought... I wish I could be more anonymous.
It's funny how that happens, isn't it? Sometimes when you're young, you want to sort of go along with everybody else. You sort of, you almost any sort of individuality or eccentricity is something to be feared. But then when you're older, I think you realise how much you morph into your own parents sometimes. And you suddenly realise that actually those idiosyncrasies actually are the things that stand out.
I think that the nice part of it too was we really got to meet everybody. From we knew, one of my favourite things was riding on the college gardener's trolley, and messing about in the potting shed with him. And then you'd go home and the Archbishop and somebody would be there for supper, and we'd have to be on our best behaviour and learn how to shake hands with, people.
Although luckily, Bishop Richards, who was the college visitor, was a wonderfully warm character. And I can remember him. Mum would make pikelets served in a silver tureen, and the best china would come out. But he'd sit on the floor with us and tell us jokes.
Yeah. So I guess you got to meet bishops and whatever, and yet also Dad would have all the kitchen people over for whatever. It was a really nice
social mix.
What was hard for Mum, sort of got sidetracked a bit, but she. Coming from her father was a policeman in Cardiff, and coming into a social situation where you were expected to host things and put on dinner parties, it must have been quite a challenge. And she rose to it admirably, but there must have been moments when she...
Because in those days...
what am I doing?
I think now a college vice-chancellor, they'd have people to do all the dinner party cooking for them. Mum did it all.
Yeah. Something very telling of that time was that Mum grew up speaking Welsh. She didn't speak English till she was seven or so.
Yeah.
But when she went to Lampeter, she didn't let on that she spoke Welsh. It was as though it wasn't expected of someone in that situation.
To be a Welsh speaker.
And I think she'd been there about 2 years before someone addressed her directly in Welsh, and she responded. And there was this gasp of, oh, lummy, she knows, knows what we were saying last time.
I was at a theme park with my children a good few years ago, and I recognised the accent of the people who were next to me, and they were clearly Welsh, and they were talking Welsh. And I thought, if only, because obviously I knew the accent, but I'd love to have just said just a set a line in Welsh, even if it was Tippenbach or Gymraeg or something, and just think, oh my God, we were just gossiping about them. I had no idea what they were talking about. But that's really, a really telling observation, actually, Vicky, because the sort of idea of you know, the disconnect between people's expectations and actually what's going on, and actually sometimes the way that you're always in some way performing, I suppose, in that sense, because obviously it was her husband, your father, who was the the important person in that sense. But it sounds like your mum's role was a phenomenal one, and she rose to the occasion. But it sounded hard work. I can't imagine the equivalent now of doing all the catering.
She would have, like, St. Cecilia's Day, remember? She'd have all the college choir. It was about 50 students for tea, I remember. And there'd be sort of 10 of these,
They did make a point of, they used to invite, I think, presidents of societies and things like that. There were certain students that always got invited, and I know new lecturers and staff always came for something personal in the house. And when the first women students Mum would have them for coffee. They probably found it a bit intimidating going into a drawing room with probably nice china. But again, another telling thing that time was, with her background as a nurse, when family planning clinics started to open, Mum volunteered at the one in Lampeter. But when they started taking women students, she thought, perhaps I shouldn't be seen there, and it could be people would be embarrassed to come or whatever, knowing that. And again, that's of its time.
Yeah, because that, I think, was around 66, was it around 65, 66, when female students, and actually the first reunion I went to of recent years anyway, in, it would have been 2018, we had three or four from that era, the first generation of female students. I mean, absurd looking back. I mean, certainly where I work at Kent, and even in my Lampeter days, I think the majority of students, certainly doing my subject, probably were female. Certainly it was evenly balanced, but hard to imagine an age when it was male only. But was that a shift that really, I mean, I'm guessing it was cumulative. You probably would have just had, it was still presumably very male dominated in those days.
I think it was, Dad was having three daughters and a fairly outspoken wife. he lived in a very female household. And I think we went to Howells in Cardiff, which was all girls boarding school. And I think he began to see how Victorian these places were for girls, and life had moved on. And he was determined that we three should all get a good education, because he could see divorces were coming, marriage was changing, girls had to be independent and have a life of their own. So he was a strong proponent always.
He belonged to a club in London, didn't he? And he was
called the Athenaeum. Yeah.
Embarrassed that they didn't take women.
When I was a student, I had to go underground. I had to go through the kitchens to go and meet him after the restaurant.
Yeah, and even in more recent years, I remember waiting for the bus, the Transcumbria. They would take me to Cardiff or Swansea, and I was just standing. And this was only about 20 years ago. And there was a sign. It may have been like the snooker club. I don't know. And it was men only. And that was into the 2000s. And I thought at the time, gosh, it may well be that there'd be women who wouldn't want to go there precisely because the culture was obviously so male dominated. But the idea that it's a male only province doesn't shine with the times.
Lampeter had its snooker club near the Black Lion, which was known as the Institute.
But the little things like Mum, she used to make our clothes when we were little. And I remember her saying she made, dungarees, little corduroy dungarees, trousers, a little top for us. And there was sort of shock in Lampeter, little girls in trousers. And Mum didn't wear a hat in church. She was the first one to stop wearing a hat
at Mother's Union.
At Mother's Union. Little rebellions, which she enjoyed. But again,
it sounds like front page stories of those days, doesn't it?
Yes.
principal's wife doesn't wear a hat in church, you know. Breaking news, yes. Just,
yeah,
but was your dad instrumental then in the in having the female, you know, students come to the college?
My impression is he was a strong proponent of that. Mm.
I think the only thing he wasn't keen on was they'd had the Harford buildings built.
Mm. Yeah.
And they weren't really designed for... You needed to adjust the design for women a bit. And I've got a feeling that it was rushed a little bit, the final decision. I mean, he was very keen for it, but... when it actually happened, it was a little bit of a mishmash of these buildings aren't, we haven't got enough bathrooms or whatever. And I think they had a bit of trouble with the architects there because they designed the desks, they had built-in desks, and they were a bit high. So they had to have specially high chairs to fit. Yeah. So Dad was involved very much in the detail little things like that.
And it sounds as though the professional, the public self and the private self, they seem to have merged. It's as you're talking, it sounds as though this was very much a family, it feels very family oriented. It feels as though, you know, he was genuinely interested in the minutiae. You know, and which I think you have to be. I mean, I've been working in this profession for quite a few years, and you know, sometimes unless you are involved in what the students are doing or in colleagues, you know, and having those conversations, then you're not going to get that sort of job satisfaction. But it's integral because you need the respect of all colleagues and students, and also, you know, you want to do a good job, and you can't do that a good job unless you have meaningful relationships and that you're trusted by everybody and treat everyone with respect. And it sounds, in that sense, of everything you're saying, that he was a very driven figure, and the fact that he lasted as long as he did, it's so funny. I'd love to know, you know, the idea that he went there, like the film Mr. Holland's Opus. You go there, think you're just there for a term, and then you know you're doing it for life. Yeah. But in his case, he really was there. What was it, something that did he sort of settle into it very early on?
I think that sort of all the political battles started, and he realised there wasn't enough money for the college to keep going for much. Have you seen his book, Moth and Phoenix?
No, but I'm aware of it, and I know he documents all of these battles in the sort of run up to it. Because the moth is a reference to the University of Wales, isn't it? The light of the university.
Yeah, that Lampeter was this little moth.
They thought Lampeter would just be snuffed out.
Yeah. Yes.
And he saw it as a phoenix that was going to...
I think he realised that financially and so on, they wouldn't survive much longer. Because again, he was, he looked at the financial records too. That was part of it. And
he came from a clerical background. Before he went into the church, he spent a few years at Corey's in the docks in Cardiff, learning how an office operates and
sort of company side of things.
He could look at figures and understand that. And it was his vicar who actually applied for him to sit an exam for the grants.
Forged his signature.
So Dad didn't know any of this till he gets a letter saying, please come to Brecon College and sit this exam. And so, but he had a little bit of that as a background to enable him to do the administration, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
One of his advices to me was, when I became a solicitor, when you want to say something, you're in a bit of a temper and you want to say something difficult or whatever, write the letter and then scrunch it up and put it in the bin and then write what you're actually going to say. And that's always stayed with me. And he was very good, I think, at expressing himself in a tactful way. Mm.
And getting right to the point, making people...
But not being afraid to be forceful.
And I think if it was the two of you would have... So your earliest memories would have been in Lampeter, pretty much.
Yeah.
But you would have been of university age yourselves during that period. So it sounds as though, and I don't know if it's the case with both of you, but it sounds as though, because I know your dad had been a student at Lampeter, but it sounds as though the two of you followed a very different sort of path. Is that right? Because you were a solicitor, but did you go a long way from Lampeter?
I went to Goldsmiths in London as far as I could go. And
I could have gone to Aberystwyth. I did apply to Aberystwyth to do law, but I'd also applied to Bristol,
yeah.
And I thought ABBA was a bit too close to home.
Yes.
And
ABBA was a little bit of the enemy too.
No, it had been.
It was. Yeah.
So yes.
Yeah. You went to Goldsmiths to do.
I went to Goldsmiths to where we were. It's another side of Dad. We were at Howells in Cardiff until I did my O levels there. So I was 16, and I'd just done my O levels, and we'd been moaning to Dad for a while. That Howells was so Victorian and, you know, as a parent, you take some of these stories with a bit of a pinch of salt. And anyway, Dad was returning us in June after an exeat, and he actually saw our housemistress being particularly obnoxious to somebody, and he just turned to my mum and said, "That's it, they're coming home, I'm taking them out."
Yeah.
So he took us out.
Well, you were due to go elsewhere anyway for the sixth form.
Yeah, No, not then. Yeah. That happened afterwards. I was going to stay on and do A levels, and it was only after he decided to take us out, and he was our hero because then he went and told the headmistress he was not paying a terms fee in lieu after what he was taking. She told him off and said, "You're in education; you should know better."
Mm-hmm.
So he was our hero anyway. So we all ended up back home out of Howells, and then Dad had to find somewhere for us all to go. The school in Lampeter then, well, when we went to Howells really because the secondary school in Lampeter was a secondary school and it was pretty much Welsh speaking. There wasn't a sixth form at that time.
I don't know, but I think the head was approaching retirement and it had sort of wasn't brilliant, but by the time, a few years on, they'd had a new headmaster and it had picked up its.
And then, so Dad was looking then for somewhere to go. I ended up going then to Atlantic College, and for the sixth form, and
I stayed on at Lampeter.
Vicky refused to go; she was so happy to be home. So she and Kate stayed on in Lampeter. Yeah,
I was once kidnapped by Burgess Hall. My sister, younger sister, and I, Kate, she died when she was 30. So, but Kate and I used to walk to school together. And some of the students, we'd wave to them as we passed sometimes. And two of them beckoned us in one day. I think it was coming up to Rag Week. Would we go and have tea with them?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a message was, so this was agreed. We went and had probably tinned fruit and sandwiches. And a message was sent to Dad that his daughters had been kidnapped. His reaction was probably, "Well, you can keep them."
Yes.
Right, I expect he stumped up something for the rag.
Yeah.
Yes, you always heard those stories of somebody, you know, suddenly being taken off on some ridiculous cruise or something, or some, you know, a rugby club kidnap of someone, and no ransom required. They're quite happy to go along with the kidnapper's wishes. But
the other big event we remember as children, the college, it would have been in 1964 or 5-ish, they used to put on a show in the Victoria Hall. And I can remember things like the rugby chaps dressing up as Tiller girls. And but they decided to do This Is Your Life on Dad.
Oh, yeah.
It was in the days of Eamon Andrews.
Yes.
And so Dad had been a bit suspicious about all the phone calls Mum was getting. And all this was being arranged behind his back. And I didn't know anything much about it, except we were taken to see the show. And we were to be taken backstage past all these rugby playing Tiller girls and the rest of it, and fair dues to Dad, they were really afraid that he would kind of say no, you know, I'm not going to come up on stage, but they did it very nicely, and we've still got the blue folder with what was written about it. In the tradition of This Is Your Life, we came on stage at the end of it.
Embarrassed him suitably.
Yeah. I think you were at school.
I'd gone away. You hadn't quite
recorded
me. They came to school to record me.
And in terms of all the sort of the things that you kept from that era, because you know, I'm surrounded here by lovely photographs and we've been talking about, and diaries came up earlier, but do you have a lot of those sort of records from the era? Do you are those mementos very important? Is it something that you've always sort of kept you know, dear to your heart? Is it important that you have those records?
Yeah, it was our childhood. It was our growing up, and
I suppose we're lucky to have a lot of records in terms of photographs. Because they were there at so many different occasions.
And then all the...
And Dad was such a writer.
Yes.
We've got a lot of different things that he wrote, whether it was... I've got his speech here on being given the freedom of Lampeter. And I came across a speech he wrote when he was invited to talk to a Welsh society for St. David's Day.
And all his sermons.
And his letters to us.
Letters he wrote every week to us, we kept those.
Because Anne lived abroad, for many years. And he kept up right till his...
Every Sunday afternoon. That was his sort of, you know, he would write to us all.
But he did a copy for my sister, Kate and I.
Yeah.
I'd get the even if we were living at home, we would get. Yeah. It was all carbon copies, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In those days,
No
electric typewriter computers or anything.
I mean, are those really sort of important? Because, I mean, we were saying as we were sort of walking here that it's often the incidental details that sort of make a composite story, that it's, you know, when we look back on particular eras, it's often not the big lectures that we remember. And it's funny how people don't tend to take photographs of lecture theatres. They've got, you know, social gatherings. People will always have photographs of them having lots of alcohol down at a student union. But when you actually say, you know, so what were your lectures like, or who taught you, or who did you sit next to, people are like, oh, I can't remember. There's no record of that kind of thing. So if there ever is any of a record like that, it takes on a completely, you know, it's priceless in a way that at the time, you know, might have just, you know, been thought to be a sort of, you know, common or garden thing. But do you have anything like that? Are there any sort of like records from that era that you look at now and think, wow?
There's old-fashioned cine films that, you know, would be clickety-clickety with, like when the college was granted, what was that? Everybody came to visit. Do you remember? We had a big dinner. I think it was when the college got grant status, university grant status. Yeah. That was a huge big thing. Got films of that. We've got films of various weddings that took place.
When Prince Philip came to open the library.
Prince Philip came in.
But there were home videos too.
Yeah. There were home videos made.
We had one holiday abroad. I mean, we were lucky to have that, but it was a skiing holiday, and there were little clips of that.
Yeah.
And most of the silly film degraded, but Mum, before it sort of disappeared altogether, Mum had someone put it on a DVD.
Yeah. Got that somewhere too.
And And when you look at something like that, it, as you say, memory plays tricks on you. But
And it's funny when you have those records sometimes, because memories of events, it can be something as all, you know, a film that you watch, and you have this apprehension of what you thought of it. But then the diary entry from the day suggests that actually, you know, maybe it's through subsequent viewings or just with the passage of time that you've reframed what happened. And having those, you know, the disjuncture between the memory of an event and the written down version of the event. And I do think the diary is an overlooked sort of resource in that sense, because you've got the official history of the college and you've got those newspaper clippings, but also to have that sort of personal testimony as well. I think that also, in order to corroborate your version of events, because there must come occasions when you look back on something and think, gosh, I was there, but I don't remember the event in the way that it's described.
So somebody put on Facebook recently, on the Lampeter Society or something, a photograph of all the kitchen staff. I think it's somebody who's working in the old library, doing some work in the college. And I was fascinated. I looked at all these faces. Sally was there, the mum's help. And she wanted to know who all these people were. And it brought back all those memories from Mrs. Page. They were solid matrons who'd worked there for 30, 40 years. Yeah. They knew every student and all their foibles. They knew who liked custard with this, who liked that sort of thing, you know. And that was a whole other sort of...
Are the two of you in touch with anyone else, staff or students from that era?
We were in touch with Tony Brothers. Sort of just...
Yes, and I knew of some of the students. I knew... I was still in touch a little bit with Anne Brace. She was there, and her married Stuart Brace, who was a student.
She one of the first girls.
She's one of the fairly early ones. I'm also in touch with Janet Gully, her father was Professor Gully in classics. Those are the closest links we have.
And a lot of the people we know have passed on, who've died. But I still go back to Lampeter now and again. It's
I love going back. It seems much small, you know, as all things always do when you're older. Things seem smaller. And,
I know, I never noticed the hills till I went away to Bristol and came back and thought, gosh, aren't they in a lovely setting?
Yeah. Do you know, yesterday, because I'm staying in Carmarthen at the moment, and I, after leaving Lampeter in 2001, I didn't go very far. I spent 3 years in Carmarthen. Of course, they ended up being the same institution, but wouldn't have known that at the time. And so I arrived yesterday, and I thought, I'll just have a quick look around Carmarthen, looked completely different, and came across the castle. And I thought, hold on, the castle. And I thought to myself, Carmarthen Castle. Yeah. And I thought, I was there for 3 years,
a
castle.
Yeah.
And I stopped there and I looked, and I thought to myself, it's obviously been here since Roman times, but how come that completely passed me by? And it's odd things like that. And you, how can you not miss, you know, something of great antiquity? But I think that is kind of the thing, because the place you're at when you're young, the way that you see the world as a school child, and then what you see going back. It took me, I think it was 16 years after leaving Lambeth before I felt remotely ready to go back, because I think it was so indelibly linked to, you know, my career, that I kind of just needed to stop and just process exactly what journey I was on. Because I felt, and I'm guessing it may have been similar for yourselves, but kind of outgrew it in the sense that after 10 years, I was having an amazing time, but it was the only place really in higher education I'd ever been. I'd got all my degrees there. And I was just aware that there was a world outside of it, and maybe I needed to finally just be a bit more confident and embrace it and seek work elsewhere. But that's really interesting about going back, because you sounds like you can go back, but were there periods when you perhaps were a bit more ambivalent?
I said I went to Goldsmiths. I went to Goldsmiths to do my sort of teacher training, basically. And I was going to do sociology and do all those things I did in the 60s, so, you know. And I came back to Trinity College for my final year because Mum wasn't very well, number of things. And to be honest, I loathed it, because it was after Goldsmiths and London, and coming back to Trinity, which at that time, this would have been 1970, 71, there was this very big, you know, push. Everything had to be in Welsh. Students were all on strike because exams should be in Welsh, etc. And I had a tough time in Trinity because I was known as the principal's daughter from Lampeter. Plus, after Goldsmiths, I found Trinity so parochial and old-fashioned. It reminded me of being back at Howells. Yeah. It was a good old-fashioned training college that looked after you, and, you know, had all these rules that we didn't have. It was an interesting experience for me. It was totally, totally different. I was quite glad to go away again then.
I think that's the most important thing, isn't it? Because what I was always aware of is my generation, by which I mean 91 to 94, had left. I stayed, and there were lots of other generations that arrived, and I made good friends and so on. But it was almost at that point of origin, which was, you know, and even to this day, even though technically I was there from 91 to 2001, it's very much the undergraduate years that I kind of put on a pedestal, I think, a bit, really. But you're then aware that other people have lives and they're starting to do some amazing things. But I'm thinking, well, I've done some amazing things on one level, but I'm still doing them in the same place. So there's a point where you think, you know, is this going to sort of be the trajectory on which I stay, or am I going to come away from that? And I, for a while, did feel that there was something parochial, but you can only really know something's parochial, perhaps, like a Truman Show sort of situation, but you only sort of know when you step away. And I think now what I've learned is that going back regularly, by which I mean once a year, is wonderful. But people sometimes say to me, oh, you know, if the right opportunity came up, would you move back? And I'm thinking, I don't think I could.
Yeah.
I don't think I should.
Yeah. And I guess for us coming back to Wales too, because then I went then from 72 until 2016. I was essentially overseas. And a couple of years back in between. And you were in Surrey and...
Yes, when I, after the degree, I did my articles in Cardiff. And I didn't, although Mum and Dad knew people in Cardiff, I didn't want them pointing them the way, you know, I had to do this on my own. I did work in Carmarthen for about 5 years when I first qualified, which I had a wonderful chap who was a sole practitioner and taught me what I hadn't learned in Cardiff. But I then went job things and marriage took me to Surrey for 20 odd years. And but it's funny how we both gravitated.
I think we both have some shades and anyway, thought we wouldn't ever come back. But it's funny how we both sort of come back to the place where I guess we were very happy as kids in Tenby.
And that's so common in families because my parents are both Welsh, but my mum's father was from Worcester. And for many years, my parents would go up to Worcester, you know, as a regular sort of, you know, holiday thing. And they ended up moving there. So when my sister and I left Wales, they thought, oh, maybe finally sort of, you know, they'd always lived in Cardiff all their lives. But they actually moved to the place, which was sort of almost like a second home, or the home that they associated, or my mum associated with her own father. So there's a sense of going back. And I do wonder in that respect, because my work with the Lampeter Society, I mean, obviously I'm not quite, I'm not at retirement age yet, but there is that sense of gravitating back and then realising, and other people who've been involved in the committee, the same thing, that they, in some cases, they may not even have enjoyed their Lampeter years, but at the end of the day, they had the Lampeter years.
Yeah.
And so it's a case of, well, whether we liked it or not, it's integral to who we are. So you find yourself in some way, you know, you can either write it off or ignore it, or because that can cause trauma in a way of like, sort of, you know, pretend it didn't happen, or you can embrace it. And that's where I kind of feel I am. And I kind of feel that the number of friendships that, I mean, obviously if I'd gone somewhere else, I would have no doubt had other friendships that were comparable. But due to the size of the place, you always saw the same people seven times a day. You didn't need mobile phones in those days. And there was that real sense of a community. And I think that is what I was always, I was mourning. Of course, nostalgia is a very sort of, as a word, it's about the bitter and the sweet. But I was kind of aware that whatever limitations there may have been in Lampeter, that was also what made it such a wonderful place.
It was those paternalistic sort of, in a nice way. Yes. I remember Dad at one time when drugs started coming in and things were suddenly you had to get the police involved and things, and they always for the first part of our growing up, I think there was the feeling that what happened while you were in college amongst the students, you may have gone off the rails a bit, but the college looked after you. But at a certain point it changed, and I know Dad bemoaned the fact that, well, this person's going to get a criminal record now, possibly. We could have dealt with it in-house, and it would have... But society, things were changing, things had to be done different ways.
I mean, what did he think of the place? Because am I right that he died in the 80s, sort of mid-ish?
He died in 84.
And so once he did retire... Did he sort of remove himself from the place, or did he stay? What was his relationship after leaving?
I think he felt very strongly he needed to get out of his successors.
Not be
around. He thought it would be a big mistake to be anywhere near Lampeter. So that, and they were very happy down here anyway. And
he did enjoy writing Moth or Phoenix, the book about the struggle.
I'll give you my copy to take away and you can borrow that. He sort of spent a year, 2 years really, first 2 years of retirement in the study next door, writing that. He had a lot of fun.
I think there was an element of him. He loved the challenge of Lampeter. He was very completely loyal to it. But there was an element of him thought, would I have been better as a pastoral vicar, perhaps?
It
sort of his... lifetime's work took it off in a trajectory he hadn't really planned, but there was an element of him who thought, well, someone up above has guided me to do this, and that's my
heart. There was a huge loyalty to Lampeter. I think he was like a dog with a bone all through the sort of late 60s, 70s, the battling to get the University Grants Committee to acknowledge Lampeter as an entity and as the oldest and so on and so on. He spent hours and hours writing letters, going up to London, trying to see people, bend people's ears. That was a lifetime's...
Yeah. We weren't aware of that struggle.
Not so much until later.
Until later. Because I remember he'd have all these trips to London to various meetings. And the first thing when he came back was Mum would ask him, what's the fashion in the windows? What's the colour this season? Little things like that.
But it's also really revealing that even though he'd been... He was probably one of the longest...
lasting vice, you know, principal, I keep saying vice chancellor, but principals, you know, to have done that job for a quarter of a century. But it sounds as though, even though he did it for so long, that he still thought that maybe there was another calling. It was William Price, who I interviewed a few years ago, who wrote the history of the college, also was literally doing two jobs, in the sense that he was a lecturer and he was also a priest.
He did keep up his... He would do guest preaching at all around
the churches. When he retired, he sort of helped out as he retired. He enjoyed doing that. I remember his little, he had a suitcase, remember, with his robes in. I can see it now. His robe case would go off on a Sunday, off he'd go and preach somewhere. Or he enjoyed that. And being useful here, you know, sort of at the local church. When he retired,
he avoided all committees, didn't he?
Yes, he did enough committees.
Yes, he wouldn't sit on. I think they established what do they call it for senior retired Rotarians? The next day.
But it's got a name, hasn't it? Yeah. Probus or something.
Probus, that's it. And he said, I think they started one in Tenby, and he said, our first rule is no committee meetings. Just meet for coffee and a chat.
Yeah. When he retired, he did actually write. I think he wrote to various august bodies to say, I'm retired now, you know, is there anything I can do to help as a volunteer? And he was quite put out, nobody wanted to know. And it was a genuine sort of free offer, you know, I'm here, I've got time. But I think then it was...
I'm glad you said that, because I often think that, you know, people often associate you with particular roles and think, oh, Chris, or in my list, Chris is good at this and so on. But sometimes you sort of feel, well, because you've always done something in a certain way, there's almost the expectation that therefore you're available. And often then you're aware that you're taking on a lot of jobs almost concurrently. You know, if you have lots of part-time jobs, you add them up and it becomes more than a full-time job. But in themselves... they're perhaps not full-time jobs, and people don't always perhaps realise all the other sort of juggling balls that there are in the air.
I think we can both identify with that.
Yeah.
I remember when I retired, Vicky came back a bit before me, really, full-time. I remember her saying to me, there's one word for the first year, no. You would be asked to be on so many, you know, no. As in, you just get, and we both got roped into lots of different things. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yes, the assumption that you're so good at it, but you're thinking, well,
that's right.
But that's also a reason sometimes why it's good not to do it.
Yeah.
Because you know, I think everyone, I suppose there are different sides of me that people see. They see the lecturing me, they see the podcast me, the film review me, the person who puts pictures on Facebook, selfies outside cinemas, and the family me, and the diarist me, and, you know, there's a whole sort of list of these things. And people sort of just see perhaps one facet of that at any one moment. But it sounds like for the two of you, do you feel in any way, particularly as it's obviously a good 40, almost exactly 40 years since your father, I don't know when your mother passed away.
96.
96.
Oh. 12 years later. Yeah.
But do you sort of look back now? Do you feel in any way that maybe as the teenager you wanted to disassociate yourself, or you wanted to be as different as possible? Do you sort of look back now and think, gosh, you sort of see your life maybe following sort of similar sort of pathways as you look back to those of your parents?
I think so. Because then I went into teaching, and then I went back to university twice. I went then into head teaching, and that's what I did for but overseas. Yeah. And but often in the back of my mind were things that Dad used to say about, you know, running a school and some of the things you said earlier. So I think in a way,
yes,
you jump out of your skin in a way, but...
I found myself being secretary of this and secretary of that and
a
good organiser.
I'm chair of the governors of the local primary school now, and I think for my sins, as if I'm, you know...
Yeah.
I enjoy it because it's the other side of the fence. I'm not responsible. Yeah. I'm just there to listen.
Yeah. But I think the other thing that comes as you get older is you're comfortable in your own skin.
Yes.
And you don't mind being a bit outspoken.
Mm. And we're getting more and more like that, aren't we? We rant at each other occasionally now.
But that's so revealing as well, because for the two of you, because there's been such a passage of time, that I guess you could sort of perhaps look, you know, you're probably aware that a lot of people from that era are no longer here. And there's that sense in which you can actually be yourselves. You don't have to
live under the shadow.
Even like you go for a job, you're always in the shadow of somebody. And even if you're the vice of the principal of an institution, you're still there are certain people you have to please, whether it's governors or educators or government of the day, University of Wales, etc. So that point almost when you can actually just sort of step back and realise that you can do things in your way, because somebody before you did it in their way, in their age, it might have been right for them at that time, but 50 years on, it probably would not be very sensible to try and apply those same principles to the same degree. And it sounds like the two of you have had a real sense of, you can see how similar you are to your parents, but also you can sort of find your own way through all of this.
Yeah, I think it's... occasionally, I look very much like my mother, I think, don't I?
Mm.
Yeah, apparently. And you never see it yourself, do you? No. And it catches me. I'm in town sometimes. And Mum was known as quite a character here in Tenby.
Mm.
And people still remember her. And I'd be in town sometimes and people will sort of, you're so like your mother. Mm. And I think, I'm so not like my mother, and yet there are things. I
look back and think
you look very like Dad.
Oh. Yeah, but we have more energy.
Yes,
in some ways. Yeah. I mean, Mum in her 40s looked like an old woman in a sense. You know, the twin set and the
I suppose
she might wear slacks occasionally, but she would never go for a long walk or. Well, I think at her age, Mum died in her 70s.
They both died at age 76.
They weren't as fit as I feel now.
I mean, I'm 72 now, and I sort of think, I've got to outlive both of them. that's my aim at the moment. And, but I sort of think, oh, quick, my next birthday, I'll be 80. You know, big birthday. And,
it's part of, the way... lives have changed. You can be more informal.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, in my case, it's interesting because I was thinking today, what shall I wear? Because we're in Tenby. and I was reflecting on this because I'm 50.
Yeah.
And I thought, gosh, when I was the age, because my dad was 50 when I went to Lampeter. My mum was 46, I think.
Mm.
So I'm older now than around the same age as my parents at that time. But they always seemed old. I mean, they're still alive, and actually they're very good for their age in some ways. But when you're 18, somebody in their 40 seems really old.
Mm.
Well, I'm 50 now, and I feel, I'd like to think of myself, I have perhaps quite a bit of energy. But it's interesting what the passage of time does, but also the generational shift. I look at my grandparents and the pictures of them and the clothes that they wore. And as you say, in their 40s, it'd be the equivalent. I think of people in their 40s now who are having children and so on. You just can't imagine that happening in the same way in a previous generation. Mm. Yeah.
I can remember Dad getting annoyed with Mum talking of clothes. What was the name of the men's outfitter in...
Daniel
I remember I got a tie from that.
Daniel Dawson was the
They had a wonderful shop with a tailor sitting at the back of the bench.
Yes, cross-legged.
But in those days you could get your clothes on Apro.
Mm.
There's BJ Jones and Daniel's
Danny Davis,
I think it was.
Yeah. And I can remember this parcel arriving in brown paper, tied up with string. Mum had got fed up with Dad's wardrobe, and it was things like cardigans and waistcoats. He often had a wool waistcoat over his suit because he didn't have a lot of heating in.
Mm.
No.
But Dad sort of said, "What do I want all? Typical man, what do I want all these clothes for?" And those can go back. But you can't imagine. Well, I suppose that was the equivalent of us applying for things by mail order these days.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, send it back.
Absolutely. And you can do this over the internet in the same way. What do you think, if your dad knew what the two of you are doing now, if he saw Lampeter today, if he saw Tenby today, what do you think, and your mother as well, I shouldn't just, it's not just about your dad, but what would they think? Would they like the evolution? Would they be surprised? Would they sort of feel that it was part of a continuum that they were very much a trajectory that they were part of, or would it seem like a very different sort of age that they wouldn't?
Would love it. I think Dad would be. I think he'd be proud of both of us.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we've both been divorced. you've remarried, we've got kids and grandkids, all that side of it, that we'd survived all those things, and the jobs he made sure we had, got sore through it all. I think he would be fascinated by the changes, and he'd have his opinions on it, but I think he'd... Mum, I think, would be more... she was always a bit more conservative.
Possibly, possibly. But they were both people.
Absolutely, nothing they liked better from Dad, his pipe and a glass of whiskey and a good long chat.
Yeah, but I'm thinking, as we start to wrap up, do you think that there are even things like, is there anything you look back at, like the music, were there any sort of things from that era? Because, obviously, this would have been from the 50s to the 70s, so I'm thinking, because with the Queen's death not too long ago, covers that same era, really, of 53 right up until almost the Silver Jubilee, that whole period. And, is there anything, in terms of the changes, was there anything that either of your parents or yourselves sort of did like or didn't like, or there was an evolution or an acceptance? This was the age of rock and roll. This was the age from the crooners to the rock and roll to the sort of everything from the 70s, which was a very different sort of musical spirit. But were they aware of that? Were you aware of that? Did they embrace it? Or was there that sense of somehow that's a different generation?
I think Dad did. I think having been a parish priest, there's not much that shocks or...
Yeah.
Parish priests are very worldly people. Mm. And then he was in the army doing the war for a long time, and I think he was an entertainment officer in the army. I mean, I think Dad enjoyed all new things and innovations and things like that.
I think he'd be disappointed the way the church is.
I was just coming to that. I think he would be horrified, actually, because they used to go to the governing body meetings, the church in Wales and things, and Dad was always quite outspoken. He was Chancellor of the diocese here as well. And he had very strong feelings about how young priests need to be trained and the position they had in the community and the workload and so on and so on. And I think he would look at it now.
I think I often wonder what he'd have thought of women priests. I mean, I think he would have... taken to it. It would have been probably a difficult thing to...
I think like all things, he'd have thought long and hard about it. He did, but Dad would have literally gone and prayed about it. Dad was very theual in that way, wasn't he? Sort of. But he'd have gone with it, I think. No, but I think he would be... very disappointed, I think. I think all the years he spent working with young priests and the church was really important to him. I think he would be disappointed. I think he'd think it was gutless and people don't speak out and they don't, I think there were certain moral things I think he would have felt very strongly about. But in a gentle sort of way, he was never...
He wasn't afraid to speak his mind.
No, but never offensively or never sort of... hurt someone. It was always done.
I was reading something he wrote just earlier when I was looking through papers, saying that it was something along the lines of people appreciate you having strong views. I'm a wishy-washy person. I just want everyone to be happy. I don't want to offend anyone. Yeah. But he wasn't.
But that can take a lot of courage as well, because often the opinionated, it's important that there are people who have opinions, but often those people with strong opinions don't always make good leaders, and those people who, but if you don't have strong opinions, you're not a very good leader. But I think actually, in a place like Lampeter as well, where a certain type of student might want to go, I mean, certainly not, it wouldn't be the right place for everyone. And I came from the city. Most of my friends went either stayed in Cardiff or went eastwards or, Oxbridge or Bristol all sorts of destinations. But I was unusual in the sense that I wanted to go westwards. But, you look back and you sometimes think that a place can really build you. And I think it's because it's a place that can be very welcoming. It has its own traditions. It has its own sort of institutions and a sense of integrity. But then you sort of around that, you can sort of work out where you fit with that. And so it's funny, isn't it, as we sort of look back and realise that, the things that the people we looked up to sometimes, or the people who seem to be on the right sort of path, might have been for a period. But actually, life changes and some people adapt far better and it's often not the people you expect. The people who adapt are the ones who might have been once stuck in their ways, and they just sort of give in. Whereas the people who seem more sort of liberal, younger, sort of like there's a point where they actually they don't go to the next stage. I find it with even talking to former Lampeter students who might have been worried once about questions of what would their parents think about such and such, about issues around sexuality and so on, and their own children now will often sort of, you know, talk about trans rights and all sorts of things. And the parents are like, oh, I thought I was really liberal, but suddenly you're making me, you know, think about something that actually was not even on the radar a few years ago. And it's just funny how our children perceive us.
They were very open about letting us know there were other things. I don't know how they would have.
I always felt they were very respectful of us having different views or viewpoints, and they would let us know what they thought, but it's your decision. And I took very seriously what they thought. But, it's a really interesting aspect of it, I think. I think they would have... I think Dad would have been... Part of him, I think, would have realised change happens and Lampeter will change, the college will change, it'll have to move with the times. I think he was very keen on giving a chance to students who perhaps wouldn't have been taken elsewhere. I always got the feeling, you know, the slightly lost one and the one who failed everything. Just give them a chance. They could function here, whereas maybe they wouldn't in another place. I think there were some lost souls that he took in at Lampeter.
And I think it's a beautiful way to wrap up, because for that reason, the number of students, particularly in geography, I mean, we sent out a call for students who had done geography here, and for the Lampeter link, they had a chance to write about their reasons for coming here and what they remember. And the story was so familiar. Didn't get the right A-level grades, never heard of Lampeter, were rejected by the institution that they hoped to go to. Lampeter took a chance on them, almost exactly the same words that Anne you just used. And then, not only that, they went to Lampeter and are now professor of geography at the University of wherever. And they, you know, so it's not as though they went to university, got their degree, got their PhD and became a full-time academic. The journey was one that could so easily, and if it had been for Lampeter, would so easily have been a very different one.
Yeah, I think that, you know, because Dad did admissions and so on too, so I think he had that personal, so he would ring parents and talk to them and stuff like that. So
we're very lucky to have such happy memories, really, of that whole era, really. But we've also made our own way, and it's as you say, you're under the shadow for a while, but that's helped you blossom.
It is, you know, I've got two sons, and I look at them, and the older one particularly, he looks very like my dad, and he's got the same kind of his character. I can't help myself thinking he's so like your grandfather in some ways. You know, you look at your kids and you see those sort of and I often wonder what Dad would have made of him, you know.
Well, I have to say, this has been an enormous privilege to meet the two of you. I mean, this I said at the beginning, when I heard from you a few months ago, I thought, well, this is, you know, the interview. I will literally go as far as it takes to do this. And you have not disappointed. No. And I'm sure that anyone and everyone listening to this will be as compelled as I have been over the last hour by your stories. But Anne and Vicky, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
No, thank you for letting us talk about it. It's been fun. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.